and the gardener looked quite different. It made her think that it was curious how much nicer a person looked when he smiled. She had not thought of it before. He turned about to the orchard side of his garden and began to whistle, a low, soft whistle. She could not understand how such a surly man could make such a coaxing sound. Almost the next moment a wonderful thing happened. She heard a soft little rushing flight through the air, and it was the bird with the red breast flying to them, and he actually alighted on the big clod of earth quite near to the gardener's foot. "Here he is," chuckled the old man, and then he spoke to the bird as if he were speaking to a child. "Where has that been, that cheeky little beggar?" he said. "I've not seen thee before today. Has thou begun thy courting this early in the season? Thou'rt too forrard." The bird put his tiny head on one side and looked up at him with his soft bright eye, which was like a black dewdrop. He seemed quite familiar and not in the least afraid. He hopped about and pecked the earth briskly, looking for seeds and insects. It actually gave Mary a queer feeling in her heart, because he was so pretty and cheerful and seemed so like a person. He had a tiny plump body and a delicate beak and slender, delicate legs. "Will he always come when you call him?" she asked, almost in a whisper.
"Aye, that he will. I've knowed him ever since he was a fledgling. He come out of the nest in the other garden, and when first he flew over the wall, he was too weak to fly back for a few days, and we got friendly. When he went over the wall again, the rest of the brood was gone, and he was lonely, and he come back to me."
"What kind of bird is he?" Mary asked.
"Doesn't tha know? He's a robin redbreast, and they're the friendliest, curiousest birds alive. They're almost as friendly as dogs, if you know how to get on with them. Watch him pecking about there and looking round at us now and again. He knows we're talking about him."
It was the queerest thing in the world to see the old fellow. He looked at the plump little scarlet waistcoated bird as if he were both proud and fond of him.
"He's a conceited one," he chuckled. "He likes to hear folk talk about him, and curious. Bless me, there never was his like for curiosity and meddling. He's always coming to see what I'm planting. He knows all the things Mester Craven never troubles hisself to find out. He's the head gardener, he is."
The robin hopped about, busily pecking the soil, and now and then stopped and looked at them a little. Mary thought his black dewdrop eyes gazed at her with great curiosity. It really seemed as if he were finding out all about her. The queer feeling in her heart increased. "Where did the rest of the brood fly to?" she asked.
"There's no knowing. The old ones turn 'em out of their nest and make 'em fly, and they're scattered before you know it. This one was a knowing one, and he knew he was lonely."
Mistress Mary went a step nearer to the robin and looked at him very hard. "I'm lonely," she said. She had not known before that this was one of the things which made her feel sour and cross. She seemed to find it out when the robin looked at her and she looked at the robin. The old gardener pushed his cap back on his bald head and stared at her a minute.
"Art thou the little wench from India?" he asked.
Mary nodded.
"Then no wonder thou'rt lonely. Thou'lt be lonelier before thou's done," he said.
He began to dig again, driving his spade deep into the rich black garden soil, while the robin hopped about, very busily employed. "What is your name?" Mary inquired. He stood up to answer her.
"Ben Weatherstaff," he answered, and then he added with a surly chuckle, "I'm lonely myself, except when he's with me," and he jerked his thumb toward the robin. "He's the only friend I've got."
"I have no friends at all," said Mary. "I never had. My Ayah didn't like me, and I never played with anyone." It is a Yorkshire habit to say what you think with blunt frankness, and old Ben Weatherstaff was a Yorkshire moorman.
"Tha and me are a good bit alike," he said. "We was wove out of the same cloth. We're neither of us good-looking, and we're both of us as sour as we look. We've got the same nasty tempers, both of us, I'll warrant." This was plain speaking, and Mary Lennox had never heard the truth about herself in her life. Native servants always salaamed and submitted to you, whatever you did. She had never thought much about her looks, but she wondered if she was as unattractive as Ben Weatherstaff, and she also wondered if she looked as sour as he had looked before the robin came. She actually began to wonder also if she was nasty-tempered. She felt uncomfortable. Suddenly a clear, rippling little sound broke out near her, and she turned round. She was standing a few feet from a young apple tree, and the robin had flown onto one of its branches and had burst out into a scrap of a song. Ben Weatherstaff laughed outright. "What did he do that for?" asked Mary.
"He's made up his mind to make friends with thee," replied Ben. "Dang me if he hasn't took a fancy to thee."
"To me?" said Mary, and she moved toward the little tree softly and looked up. "Would you make friends with me?" she said to the robin, just as if she was speaking to a person. "Would you?" And she did not say it either in her hard little voice or in her imperious Indian voice, but in a tone so soft and eager and coaxing that Ben Weatherstaff was as surprised as she had been when she heard him whistle.
"Why!" he cried out. "Tha said that as nice and human as if thou was a real child instead of a sharp old woman. Tha said it almost like Dickon talks to his wild things on the moor."
"Do you know Dickon?" Mary asked, turning round rather in a hurry.
"Everybody knows him. Dickon's wandering about everywhere. The very blackberries and heatherbells knows him. I warrant the foxes shows him where their cubs lies, and the skylarks doesn't hide their nests from him."
Mary would have liked to ask some more questions. She was almost as curious about Dickon as she was about the deserted garden. But just that moment, the robin, who had ended his song, gave a little shake of his wings, spread them, and flew away. He had made his visit, and had other things to do.
"He has flown over the wall," Mary cried out, watching him. "He has flown into the orchard. He has flown across the other wall, into the garden where there is no door."
"He lives there," said old Ben. "He came out of the egg there. If he's caught in, he's making up to some young madam of a robin that lives among the old rose trees there."
"Rose trees?" said Mary. "Are there rose trees?"
Ben Weatherstaff took up his spade again and began to dig.
"There were 10 years ago," he mumbled.
"I should like to see them," said Mary. "Where is the green door? There must be a door somewhere."
Ben drove his spade deep and looked as uncompanionable as he had looked when she first saw him.
"There were 10 years ago, but there isn't now," he said.
"No door?" cried Mary. "There must be."
"None as anyone can find, and none as is anyone's business. Don't you be a meddlesome wench and poke your nose where it's no cause to go. Here, I must go on with my work. Get you gone and play you. I've no more time."
And he actually stopped digging, threw his spade over his shoulder, and walked off, without even glancing at her or saying goodbye. Chapter 5. The Cry in the Corridor. At first, each day which passed by for Mary Lennox was exactly like the others. Every morning she awoke in her tapestried room and found Martha kneeling upon the hearth building her fire. Every morning she ate her breakfast in the nursery, which had nothing amusing in it, and after each breakfast she gazed out of the window across to the huge moor, which seemed to spread out on all sides and climb up to the sky. And after she had stared for a while, she realized that if she did not go out, she would have to stay in and do nothing, and so she went out. She did not know that this was the best thing she could have done, and she did not know that when she began to walk quickly or even run along the paths and down the avenue, she was stirring her slow blood and making herself stronger by fighting with the wind which swept down from the moor.
She ran only to make herself warm, and she hated the wind, which rushed at her face and roared and held her back as if it were some giant she could not see. But the big breaths of rough, fresh air blown over the heather filled her lungs with something which was good for her whole thin body and whipped some red colour into her cheeks and brightened her dull eyes when she did not know anything about it. But after a few days spent almost entirely out of doors, she wakened one morning knowing what it was to be hungry, and when she sat down to her breakfast, she did not glance disdainfully at her porridge and push it away, but took up her spoon and began to eat it, and went on eating it until her bowl was empty. "Tha got on well enough with that this morning, didn't tha?" said Martha.
"It tastes nice today," said Mary, feeling a little surprised herself.
"It's the air of the moor that's given thee stomach for thy victuals," answered Martha. "It's lucky for thee that thou's got victuals as well as appetite. There's been 12 in our cottage as had the stomach and nothing to put in it. You go on playing you out of doors every day, and you'll get some flesh on your bones, and you won't be so yeller."
"I don't play," said Mary. "I have nothing to play with."
"Nothing to play with?" exclaimed Martha. "Our children plays with sticks and stones. They just runs about and shouts and looks at things."
Mary did not shout, but she looked at things. There was nothing else to do. She walked round and round the gardens and wandered about the paths in the park. Sometimes she looked for Ben Weatherstaff, but though several times she saw him at work, he was too busy to look at her or was too surly. Once, when she was walking toward him, he picked up his spade and turned away as if he did it on purpose. One place she went to oftener than to any other. It was the long walk outside the gardens with the walls round them. There were bare flower beds on either side of it, and against the walls ivy grew thickly. There was one part of the wall where the creeping dark green leaves were more bushy than elsewhere. It seemed as if for a long time that part had been neglected. The rest of it had been clipped and made to look neat, but at this lower end of the walk it had not been trimmed at all. A few days after she had talked to Ben Weatherstaff, Mary stopped to notice this and wondered why it was so. She had just paused and was looking up at a long spray of ivy swinging in the wind when she saw a gleam of scarlet and heard a brilliant chirp, and there, on the top of the wall, perched Ben Weatherstaff's robin redbreast, tilting forward to look at her with his small head on one side.
"Oh," she cried out, "is it you? Is it you?"
And it did not seem at all queer to her that she spoke to him as if she was sure that he would understand and answer her. He did answer. He twittered and chirped and hopped along the wall as if he were telling her all sorts of things. It seemed to Mistress Mary as if she understood him too, though he was not speaking in words. It was as if he said, "Good morning. Isn't the wind nice? Isn't the sun nice? Isn't everything nice? Let us both chirp and hop and twitter. Come on, come on." Mary began to laugh, and as he hopped and took little flights along the wall, she ran after him. Poor little thin, sallow, ugly Mary. She actually looked almost pretty for a moment.
"I like you, I like you," she cried out, pattering down the walk,
and she chirped and tried to whistle, which last she did not know how to do in the least. But the robin seemed to be quite satisfied, and chirped and whistled back at her. At last he spread his wings and made a darting flight to the top of a tree, where he perched and sang loudly. That reminded Mary of the first time she had seen him. He had been swinging on a treetop then, and she had been standing in the orchard. Now she was on the other side of the orchard, and standing in the path outside a wall, much lower down, and there was the same tree inside.
"It's in the garden no one can go into," she said to herself. "It's the garden without a door. He lives in there. How I wish I could see what it is like."
She ran up the walk to the green door she had entered the first morning. Then she ran down the path through the other door and then into the orchard. And when she stood and looked up, There was the tree on the other side of the wall, and there was the robin just finishing his song and beginning to preen his feathers with his beak.
"It is the garden," she said. "I am sure it is."
She walked round and looked closely at that side of the orchard wall, but she only found what she had found before, that there was no door in it. Then she ran through the kitchen gardens again and out into the walk outside the long ivy-covered wall, and she walked to the end of it and looked at it, but there was no door. And then she walked to the other end, looking again, but there was no door.
"It's very queer," she said.
"Ben Weatherstaff said there was no door, and there is no door. But there must have been one 10 years ago, because Mr. Craven buried the key." This gave her so much to think of that she began to be quite interested and feel that she was not sorry that she had come to Misselthwaite Manor. In India, she had always felt hot and too languid to care much about anything. The fact was that the fresh wind from the moor had begun to blow the cobwebs out of her young brain and to waken her up a little. She stayed out of doors nearly all day, and when she sat down to her supper at night, she felt hungry and drowsy and comfortable. She did not feel cross when Martha chattered away. She felt as if she rather liked to hear her, and at last she thought she would ask her a question. She asked it after she had finished her supper and had sat down on the hearth rug before the fire.
"Why did Mr. Craven hate the garden?" she said.
She had made Martha stay with her, and Martha had not objected at all. She was very young and used to a crowded cottage full of brothers and sisters, and she found it dull in the great servants' hall downstairs, where the footman and upper housemaids made fun of her Yorkshire speech and looked down upon her as a common little thing and sat and whispered among themselves. Martha liked to talk, and the strange child who had lived in India and been waited upon by blacks was novelty enough to attract her. She sat down on the hearth herself without waiting to be asked.
"Art thou thinking about that garden yet?" she said. "I knew thou would. That was just the way with me when I first heard about it."
"Why did he hate it?" Mary persisted.
Martha tucked her feet under her and made herself quite comfortable.
"Listen to the wind wuthering round the house," she said. "You could bear stand up on the moor if you was out on it tonight."
Mary did not know what "wuthering" meant until she listened, and then she understood. It must mean that hollow, shuddering sort of roar which rushed round and round the house, as if the giant no one could see were buffeting it and beating at the walls and windows to try to break in. But one knew he could not get in, and somehow it made one feel very safe and warm inside a room with a red coal fire.
"But why did he hate it so?"
she asked, after she had listened. She intended to know if Martha did. Then Martha gave up her store of knowledge.
"Mind," she said, "Mrs. Medlock said it's not to be talked about. There's lots of things in this place that's not to be talked over. That's Mr. Craven's orders. His troubles are none servant's business, he says. But for the garden he wouldn't be like he is. It was Mrs. Craven's garden that she had made when first they were married, and she just loved it, and they used to tend the flowers themselves. And none of the gardeners was ever let to go in. Him and her used to go in and shut the door and stay there hours and hours, reading and talking. And she was just a bit of a girl, and there was an old tree with a branch bent like a seat on it, and she made roses grow over it, and she used to sit there. But one day when she was sitting there, the branch broke and she fell on the ground and was hurt so bad that next day she died. The doctors thought he'd go out of his mind and die too. That's why he hates it. No one's never gone in since, and he won't let anyone talk about it."
Mary did not ask any more questions. She looked at the red fire and listened to the wind, wuthering. It seemed to be wuthering louder than ever. At that moment, a very good thing was happening to her. 4 good things had happened to her, in fact, since she came to Misselthwaite Manor. She had felt as if she had understood a robin and that he had understood her. She had run in the wind until her blood had grown warm. She had been healthily hungry for the first time in her life, and she had found out what it was to be sorry for someone. She was getting on. But as she was listening to the wind, she began to listen to something else. She did not know what it was, because at first she could scarcely distinguish it from the wind itself. It was a curious sound. It seemed almost as if a child were crying somewhere. Sometimes the wind sounded rather like a child crying, but presently Mistress Mary felt quite sure that this sound was inside the house, not outside it. It was far away, but it was inside. She turned round and looked at Martha. "Do you hear anyone crying?" she said. Martha suddenly looked confused. "No," she answered. "It's the wind. Sometimes it sounds like as if someone was lost on the moor and wailing. It's got all sorts of sounds." "But listen," said Mary. "It's in the house, down one of those long corridors." And at that very moment, a door must have been opened somewhere downstairs, for a great rushing draught blew along the passage, and the door of the room they sat in was blown open with a crash. And as they both jumped to their feet, the light was blown out, and the crying sound was swept down the far corridor, so that it was to be heard more plainly than ever. "There," said Mary. "I told you so. It is someone crying, and it isn't a grown-up person." Martha ran and shut the door and turned the key. But before she did it, they both heard the sound of a door in some far passage shutting with a bang, and then everything was quiet, for even the wind ceased wuthering for a few moments. "It was the wind," said Martha stubbornly. "And if it wasn't, it was little Betty Butterworth, the scullery maid. She's had the toothache all day." But something troubled and awkward in her manner made Mistress Mary stare very hard at her. She did not believe she was speaking the truth. Chapter 6. There was someone crying. There was. The next day the rain poured down in torrents again, and when Mary looked out of her window, the moor was almost hidden by grey mist and cloud. There could be no going out today. "What do you do in your cottage when it rains like this?" she asked Martha. "Try to keep from under each other's feet, mostly," Martha answered. "Eh, there does seem a lot of us, then. Mother's a good-tempered woman, but she gets fair moithered. The biggest ones goes out in the cowshed and plays there. Dickon, he doesn't mind the wet. He goes out just the same as if the sun was shining. He says he sees things on rainy days as doesn't show when it's fair weather. He once found a little fox cub half drowned in its hole, and he brought it home in the bosom of his shirt to keep it warm. Its mother had been killed nearby, and the hole was swum out, and the rest of the litter was dead. He's got it at home now. He found a half-drowned young crow another time, and he brought it home too and tamed it. It's named Soot because it's so black, and it hops and flies about with him everywhere." The time had come when Mary had forgotten to resent Martha's familiar talk. She had even begun to find it interesting, and to be sorry when she stopped or went away. The stories she had been told by her Ayah when she lived in India had been quite unlike those Martha had to tell about the moorland cottage which held 14 people who lived in 4 little rooms and never had quite enough to eat. The children seemed to tumble about and amuse themselves like a litter of rough, good-natured collie puppies. Martha was most attracted by the mother and Dickon. When Martha told stories of what Mother said or did, they always sounded comfortable. "If I had a raven or a fox cub, I could play with it," said Mary. "But I have nothing." Martha looked perplexed. "Can tha knit?" she asked. "No," answered Mary. "Can tha sew?" "No." "Can tha read?" "Yes." "Then why doesn't tha read something, or learn a bit of spelling? Tha'st old enough to be learning tha book a good bit now."
"I haven't any books," said Mary. "Those I had were left in India."
"That's a pity," said Martha. "If Mrs. Medlock had let thee go into the library, there's thousands of books there." Mary did not ask where the library was, because she was suddenly inspired by a new idea. She made up her mind to go and find it herself. She was not troubled about Mrs. Medlock. Mrs. Medlock seemed always to be in her comfortable housekeeper's sitting room downstairs. In this queer place, one scarcely ever saw anyone at all. In fact, there was no one to see but the servants, and when their master was away, they lived a luxurious life below stairs, where there was a huge kitchen hung about with shining brass and pewter, and a large servants' hall, where there were four or five abundant meals eaten every day, and where a great deal of lively romping went on when Mrs. Medlock was out of the way. Mary's meals were served regularly, and Martha waited on her, but no one troubled themselves about her in the least. Mrs. Medlock came and looked at her every day or two, but no one inquired what she did or told her what to do. She supposed that perhaps this was the English way of treating children. In India she had always been attended by her ayah, who had followed her about and waited on her hand and foot. She had often been tired of her company. Now she was followed by nobody and was learning to dress herself, because Martha looked as though she thought she was silly and stupid when she wanted to have things handed to her and put on. "Hasn't thou got good sense?" she said once, when Mary had stood waiting for her to put on her gloves for her. "Ah, Susan Ann is twice as sharp as thee, and she's only 4 year old. Sometimes thou looks fair soft in the head." Mary had worn her contrary scowl for an hour after that, but it made her think several entirely new things. She stood at the window for about 10 minutes this morning, after Martha had swept up the hearth for the last time and gone downstairs. She was thinking over the new idea which had come to her when she heard of the library. She did not care very much about the library itself, because she had read very few books, but to hear of it brought back to her mind the 100 rooms with closed doors. She wondered if they were all really locked, and what she would find if she could get into any of them. Were there 100, really? Why shouldn't she go and see how many doors she could count? It would be something to do on this morning when she could not go out. She had never been taught to ask permission to do things, and she knew nothing at all about authority, so she would not have thought it necessary to ask Mrs. Medlock if she might walk about the house, even if she had seen her. She opened the door of the room and went into the corridor, and then she began her wanderings. It was a long corridor, and it branched into other corridors, and it led her up short flights of steps which mounted to others again. There were doors and doors, and there were pictures on the walls. Sometimes they were pictures of dark, curious landscapes, but oftenest they were portraits of men and women in queer, grand costumes made of satin and velvet. She found herself in one long gallery whose walls were covered with these portraits. She had never thought there could be so many in any house. She walked slowly down this place and stared at the faces, which also seemed to stare at her. She felt as if they were wondering what a little girl from India was doing in their house. Some were pictures of children, little girls in thick satin frocks which reached to their feet and stood out about them, and boys with puffed sleeves and lace collars and long hair, or with big ruffs around their necks. She always stopped to look at the children and wonder what their names were and where they had gone and why they wore such odd clothes. There was a stiff, plain little girl rather like herself. She wore a green brocade dress and held a green parrot on her finger. Her eyes had a sharp, curious look. "Where do you live now?" said Mary aloud to her. "I wish you were here." Surely no other little girl ever spent such a queer morning. It seemed as if there was no one in all the huge rambling house but her own small self, wandering about upstairs and down, through narrow passages and wide ones, where it seemed to her that no one but herself had ever walked. Since so many rooms had been built, people must have lived in them, but it all seemed so empty that she could not quite believe it true. It was not until she climbed to the second floor that she thought of turning the handle of a door. All the doors were shut, as Mrs. Medlock had said they were, but at last she put her hand on the handle of one of them and turned it. She was almost frightened for a moment when she felt that it turned without difficulty, and that when she pushed upon the door itself, it slowly and heavily opened.
It was a massive door and opened into a big bedroom. There were embroidered hangings on the wall, and inlaid furniture such as she had seen in India stood about the room. A broad window with leaded panes looked out upon the moor, and over the mantel was another portrait of the stiff, plain little girl who seemed to stare at her more curiously than ever.
"Perhaps she slept here once," said Mary. "She stares at me so that she makes me feel queer."
After that, she opened more doors and more. She saw so many rooms that she became quite tired and began to think that there must be 100, though she had not counted them. In all of them, there were old pictures or old tapestries with strange scenes worked on them. There were curious pieces of furniture and curious ornaments in nearly all of them. In one room, which looked like a lady's sitting room, the hangings were all embroidered velvet, and in a cabinet were about 100 little elephants made of ivory. They were of different sizes, and some had their mahouts or palanquins on their backs. Some were much bigger than the others, and some were so tiny that they seemed only babies. Mary had seen carved ivory in India, and she knew all about elephants. She opened the door of the cabinet and stood on a footstool and played with these for quite a long time. When she got tired, she set the elephants in order and shut the door of the cabinet. In all her wanderings through the long corridors and the empty rooms, she had seen nothing alive, but in this room she saw something. Just after she had closed the cabinet door, she heard a tiny rustling sound. It made her jump and look around at the sofa by the fireplace, from which it seemed to come. In the corner of the sofa there was a cushion, and in the velvet which covered it there was a hole, and out of the hole peeped a tiny head with a pair of frightened eyes in it. Mary crept softly across the room to look. The bright eyes belonged to a little grey mouse, and the mouse had eaten a hole into the cushion and made a comfortable nest there. 6 baby mice were cuddled up asleep near her. If there was no one else alive in the 100 rooms, there were 7 mice who did not look lonely at all.
"If they wouldn't be so frightened, I would take them back with me," said Mary.
She had wandered about long enough to feel too tired to wander any farther, and she turned back. 2 or 3 times she lost her way by turning down the wrong corridor and was obliged to ramble up and down until she found the right one. But at last she reached her own floor again, though she was some distance from her own room and did not know exactly where she was.
"I believe I have taken a wrong turning again," she said, standing still at what seemed the end of a short passage with tapestry on the wall. "I don't know which way to go. How still everything is."
It was while she was standing here, and just after she had said this, that the stillness was broken by a sound. It was another cry, but not quite like the one she had heard last night. It was only a short one, a fretful, childish whine muffled by passing through walls.
"It's nearer than it was," said Mary, her heart beating rather faster. "And it is crying."
She put her hand accidentally upon the tapestry near her and then sprang back, feeling quite startled. The tapestry was the covering of a door, which fell open and showed her that there was another part of the corridor behind it, and Mrs. Medlock was coming up to it with her bunch of keys in her hand and a very cross look on her face. "What are you doing here?" she said, and she took Mary by the arm and pulled her away. "What did I tell you?"
"I turned round the wrong corner," explained Mary. "I didn't know which way to go, and I heard someone crying."
She quite hated Mrs. Medlock at the moment, but she hated her more the next.
"You didn't hear anything of the sort," said the housekeeper. "You come along back to your own nursery, or I'll box your ears."
And she took her by the arm and half pushed, half pulled her up one passage and down another, until she pushed her in at the door of her own room.
"Now," she said, "you stay where you're told to stay, or you'll find yourself locked up. The master had better get you a governess, same as he said he would. You're one that needs someone to look sharp after you. I've got enough to do."
She went out of the room and slammed the door after her, and Mary went and sat on the hearthrug, pale with rage. She did not cry, but ground her teeth.
There was someone crying. There was. There was, she said to herself.
She had heard it twice now, and sometime she would find out. She had found out a great deal this morning. She felt as if she had been on a long journey, and at any rate she had had something to amuse her all the time, and she had played with the ivory elephants, and had seen the grey mouse and its babies in their nest in the velvet cushion.
Chapter 7 The Key of the Garden.
2 days after this, when Mary opened her eyes, she sat upright in bed immediately and called to Martha.
Look at the moor! Look at the moor!
The rainstorm had ended, and the grey mist and clouds had been swept away in the night by the wind. The wind itself had ceased, and a brilliant deep blue sky arched high over the moorland. Never, never had Mary dreamed of a sky so blue. In India, skies were hot and blazing. This was of a deep, cool blue which almost seemed to sparkle like the waters of some lovely bottomless lake. And here and there, high, high in the arched blueness, floated small clouds of snow-white fleece. The far-reaching world of the moor itself looked softly blue instead of gloomy purple-black or awful dreary grey.
"Aye," said Martha with a cheerful grin. "The storm's over for a bit. It does this at this time of the year. It goes off in a night like it was pretending it had never been here and never meant to come again. That's because the springtime's on its way. It's a long way off yet, but it's coming."
"I thought perhaps it always rained or looked dark in England," Mary said.
"Eh, no," said Martha, sitting up on her heels among her black lead brushes. "Nout of the sort."
"What does that mean?" asked Mary seriously.
In India, the natives spoke different dialects, which only a few people understood, so she was not surprised when Martha used words she did not know. Martha laughed as she had done the first morning.
"There now," she said. "I've talked broad Yorkshire again like Mrs. Medlock said I mustn't. Nout of the sort means nothing of the sort, slowly and carefully. But it takes so long to say it. Yorkshire's the sunniest place on earth when it's sunny. I told thee thou'd like the moor after a bit. Just you wait till you see the gold-coloured gorse blossoms and the blossoms of the broom and the heather flowering, all purple bells, and hundreds of butterflies fluttering and bees humming and skylarks soaring up and singing. You'll want to get out on it at sunrise and live out on it all day like Dickon does."
"Could I ever get there?" asked Mary wistfully, looking through her window at the far-off blue. It was so new and big and wonderful, and such a heavenly colour.
"I don't know," answered Martha. "Thou's never used thy legs since thou was born, it seems to me. Thou couldn't walk 5 mile. It's 5 mile to our cottage."
"I should like to see your cottage."
Martha stared at her a moment curiously before she took up her polishing brush and began to rub the grate again. She was thinking that the small, plain face did not look quite as sour at this moment as it had done the first morning she saw it. It looked just a trifle like little Susan Ann's when she wanted something very much.
"I'll ask my mother about it," she said. "She's one of them that nearly always sees a way to do things. It's my day out today, and I'm going home.
Eh, I am glad. Mrs. Medlock thinks a lot of mother. Perhaps she could talk to her."
"I like your mother," said Mary.
"I should think that did," agreed Martha, polishing away.
"I've never seen her," said Mary.
"No, thou hasn't," replied Martha.
She sat up on her heels again and rubbed the end of her nose with the back of her hand as if puzzled for a moment. But she ended quite positively.
"Well, she's that sensible and hard-working and good-natured and clean that no one could help liking her whether they'd seen her or not. When I'm going home to her on my day out, I just jump for joy when I'm crossing the moor."
"I like Dickon," added Mary, "and I've never seen him."
"Well," said Martha stoutly,
I've told thee that the very birds likes him, and the rabbits and wild sheep and ponies, and the foxes themselves.
I wonder, staring at her reflectively, what Dickon would think of thee.
He wouldn't like me, said Mary in her stiff, cold little way. No one does.
Martha looked reflective again.
How does tha like thysel? She inquired, really quite as if she were curious to know.
Mary hesitated a moment and thought it over.
Not at all, really, she answered. But I never thought of that before.
Martha grinned a little as if at some homely recollection.
Mother said that to me once, she said. She was at her washtub, and I was in a bad temper and talking ill of folk, and she turns round on me and says, "Tha young vixen, tha, there tha stands, seeing tha doesn't like this one and tha doesn't like that one. How does tha like thysel?" It made me laugh, and it brought me to my senses in a minute.
She went away in high spirits as soon as she had given Mary her breakfast. She was going to walk 5 miles across the moor to the cottage, and she was going to help her mother with the washing and do the week's baking and enjoy herself thoroughly. Mary felt lonelier than ever when she knew she was no longer in the house. She went out into the garden as quickly as possible, and the first thing she did was to run round and round the fountain flower garden 10 times. She counted the times carefully, and when she had finished, she felt in better spirits. The sunshine made the whole place look different. The high, deep blue sky arched over Misselthwaite as well as over the moor, and she kept lifting her face and looking up into it, trying to imagine what it would be like to lie down on one of the little snow-white clouds and float about. She went into the first kitchen garden and found Ben Weatherstaff working there with 2 other gardeners. The change in the weather seemed to have done him good. He spoke to her of his own accord.
"Springtime's coming," he said. "Cannot tha smell it?"
Mary sniffed and thought she could.
"I smell something nice and fresh and damp," she said.
"That's the good rich earth," he answered, digging away. "It's in a good humour, making ready to grow things. It's glad when planting time comes. It's dull in the winter when it's got nowt to do. In the flower gardens out there, things will be stirring down below in the dark. The sun's warming 'em. You'll see bits of green spikes sticking out of the black earth after a bit."
"What will they be?" asked Mary.
"Crocuses and snowdrops and daffy-down-dillies. Hast thou never seen them?"
"No. Everything is hot and wet and green after the rains in India," said Mary. "And I think things grow up in a night."
"These won't grow up in a night," said Weatherstaff. "They'll have to wait for 'em. They'll poke up a bit higher here and push out a spike more there and uncurl a leaf this day and another that. You watch 'em."
"I am going to," answered Mary.
Very soon she heard the soft, rustling flight of wings again, and she knew at once that the robin had come again. He was very pert and lively, and hopped about so close to her feet, and put his head on one side and looked at her so slyly, that she asked Ben Weatherstaff a question.
"Do you think he remembers me?" she said.
"Remembers thee?" said Weatherstaff indignantly. "He knows every cabbage stump in the gardens, let alone the people. He's never seen a little wench here before, and he's bent on finding out all about thee. There's no need to try to hide anything from him."
"Are things stirring down below in the dark in that garden where he lives?" Mary inquired.
"What garden?" grunted Weatherstaff, becoming surly again.
"The one where the old rose trees are," she could not help asking, because she wanted so much to know. "Are all the flowers dead, or do some of them come again in the summer? Are there ever any roses?"
"Ask him," said Ben Weatherstaff, hunching his shoulders toward the robin. "He's the only one as knows. No one else has seen inside it for 10 year."
10 years was a long time, Mary thought. She had been born 10 years ago. She walked away, slowly thinking.
She had begun to like the garden, just as she had begun to like the robin and Dickon and Martha's mother. She was beginning to like Martha, too. That seemed a good many people to like when you were not used to liking. She thought of the robin as one of the people. She went to her walk outside the long, ivy-covered wall over which she could see the treetops, and the second time she walked up and down, the most interesting and exciting thing happened to her, and it was all through Ben Weatherstaff's robin. She heard a chirp and a twitter, and when she looked at the bare flower-bed at her left side, there he was, hopping about and pretending to peck things out of the earth to persuade her that he had not followed her. But she knew he had followed her, and the surprise so filled her with delight that she almost trembled a little. "You do remember me," she cried out. "You do! You are prettier than anything else in the world!" She chirped and talked and coaxed, and he hopped and flirted his tail and twittered. It was as if he were talking. His red waistcoat was like satin, and he puffed his tiny breast out, and was so fine and so grand and so pretty that it was really as if he were showing her how important and like a human person a robin could be. Mistress Mary forgot that she had ever been contrary in her life when he allowed her to draw closer and closer to him, and bend down and talk and try to make something like robin sounds. Oh, to think that he should actually let her come as near to him as that! He knew nothing in the world would make her put out her hand toward him or startle him in the least, tiniest way. He knew it because he was a real person, only nicer than any other person in the world. She was so happy that she scarcely dared to breathe. The flower bed was not quite bare. It was bare of flowers because the perennial plants had been cut down for their winter rest, but there were tall shrubs and low ones which grew together at the back of the bed, and as the robin hopped about under them, she saw him hop over a small pile of freshly turned up earth. He stopped on it to look for a worm. The earth had been turned up because a dog had been trying to dig up a mole, and he had scratched quite a deep hole. Mary looked at it, not really knowing why the hole was there, and as she looked, she saw something almost buried in the newly turned soil. It was something like a ring of rusty iron or brass, and when the robin flew up into a tree nearby, she put out her hand and picked the ring up. It was more than a ring, however. It was an old key, which looked as if it had been buried a long time. Mistress Mary stood up and looked at it with an almost frightened face as it hung from her finger. "Perhaps it has been buried for 10 years," she said in a whisper. "Perhaps it is the key to the garden."
Chapter 8. The Robin Who Showed the Way. She looked at the key quite a long time. She turned it over and over and thought about it. As I have said before, she was not a child who had been trained to ask permission or consult her elders about things. All she thought about the key was that if it was the key to the closed garden, and she could find out where the door was, she could perhaps open it and see what was inside the walls and what had happened to the old rose trees. It was because it had been shut up so long that she wanted to see it. It seemed as if it must be different from other places, and that something strange must have happened to it during 10 years. Besides that, if she liked it, she could go into it every day and shut the door behind her, and she could make up some play of her own and play it quite alone, because nobody would ever know where she was, but would think the door was still locked and the key buried in the earth. The thought of that pleased her very much. Living, as it were, all by herself in a house with 100 mysteriously closed rooms and having nothing whatever to do to amuse herself had set her inactive brain to working and was actually awakening her imagination. There is no doubt that the fresh, strong, pure air from the moor had a great deal to do with it. Just as it had given her an appetite, and fighting with the wind had stirred her blood, so the same things had stirred her mind. In India she had always been too hot and languid and weak to care much about anything, but in this place she was beginning to care and to want to do new things. Already she felt less contrary, though she did not know why. She put the key in her pocket and walked up and down her walk. No one but herself ever seemed to come there, so she could walk slowly and look at the wall, or rather at the ivy growing on it. The ivy was the baffling thing. Howsoever carefully she looked, she could see nothing but thickly growing, glossy, dark green leaves. She was very much disappointed. Something of her contrariness came back to her as she paced the walk and looked over it at the treetops inside. It seemed so silly, she said to herself, to be near it and not be able to get in. She took the key in her pocket when she went back to the house, and she made up her mind that she would always carry it with her when she went out, so that if she ever should find the hidden door, she would be ready. Mrs. Medlock had allowed Martha to sleep all night at the cottage, but she was back at her work in the morning with cheeks redder than ever and in the best of spirits. "I got up at 4 o'clock," she said. "Eh, it was pretty on the moor with the birds getting up and the rabbits scampering about and the sun rising. I didn't walk all the way. A man gave me a ride in his cart, and I can tell you I did enjoy myself." She was full of stories of the delights of her day out. Her mother had been glad to see her, and they had got the baking and washing all out of the way. She had even made each of the children a dough cake with a bit of brown sugar in it. "I had 'em all piping hot when they came in from playing on the moor, and the cottage all smelt o' nice, clean, hot bacon, and there was a good fire, and they just shouted for joy. Our Dickon, he said our cottage was good enough for a king to live in." In the evening they had all sat round the fire, and Martha and her mother had sewed patches on torn clothes and mended stockings, and Martha had told them about the little girl who had come from India, and who had been waited on all her life by what Martha called blacks, until she didn't know how to put on her own stockings. "Eh, they did like to hear about you," said Martha. "They wanted to know all about the blacks and about the ship you came in. I couldn't tell them enough." Mary reflected a little. "I'll tell you a great deal more before your next day out," she said, "so that you will have more to talk about. I dare say they would like to hear about riding on elephants and camels and about the officers going to hunt tigers." "My word," cried delighted Martha. "It would set 'em clean off their heads. Would they really do that, miss? It would be same as a wild beast show like we heard they had in York once." "India's quite different from Yorkshire," Mary said slowly, as she thought the matter over. "I never thought of that. Did Dickon and your mother like to hear you talk about me?" "Why, our Dickon's eyes nearly started out of his head, they got that round," answered Martha. "But mother, she was put out about your seeming to be all by yourself, like. She said, 'Hasn't Mr. Craven got no governess for her, nor no nurse?' And I said, 'No, he hasn't, though Mrs. Medlock says he will when he thinks of it, but she says he mayn't think of it for 2 or 3 years.' 'I don't want a governess,' said Mary sharply. 'But mother says you ought to be learning your book by this time, and you ought to have a woman to look after you. And she says, 'Now, Martha, you just think how you'd feel yourself in a big place like that, wandering about all alone, and no mother. You do your best to cheer her up,' she says, and I said I would." Mary gave her a long, steady look. "You do cheer me up," she said. "I like to hear you talk." Presently Martha went out of the room and came back with something held in her hands under her apron. "What does tha think?" she said with a cheerful grin. "I've brought thee a present."
"A present?" exclaimed Mistress Mary. How could a cottage full of 14 hungry people give anyone a present?
"A man was driving across the moor peddling," Martha explained, "and he stopped his cart at our door. He had pots and pans and odds and ends, but mother had no money to buy anything. Just as he was going away, our Elizabeth Ellen called out, 'Mother, he's got skipping ropes with red and blue handles.' And mother, she calls out quite sudden, 'Here, stop, mister, how much are they?' And he says, 'Tuppence.'
And mother, she began fumbling in her pocket, and she says to me, "Martha, tha's brought me thy wages like a good lass, and I've got four places to put every penny. But I'm just going to take twopence out of it to buy that child a skipping rope." And she bought one, and here it is.
She brought it out from under her apron and exhibited it quite proudly. It was a strong, slender rope with a striped red and blue handle at each end. But Mary Lennox had never seen a skipping rope before. She gazed at it with a mystified expression.
"What is it for?" she asked curiously.
"For?" cried out Martha. "Does that mean that they've not got skipping ropes in India, for all they've got elephants and tigers and camels? No wonder most of 'em's black. This is what it's for. Just watch me."
And she ran into the middle of the room and, taking a handle in each hand, began to skip and skip and skip, while Mary turned in her chair to stare at her, and the queer faces in the old portraits seemed to stare at her too, and wonder what on earth this common little cottager had the impudence to be doing under their very noses. But Martha did not even see them. The interest and curiosity in Mistress Mary's face delighted her, and she went on skipping and counted as she skipped until she had reached 100.
"I could skip longer than that," she said when she stopped. "I've skipped as much as 500 when I was 12, but I wasn't as fat then as I am now when I was in practice."
Mary got up from her chair, beginning to feel excited herself.
"It looks nice," she said. "Your mother is a kind woman. Do you think I could ever skip like that?"
"You just try it," urged Martha, handing her the skipping rope. "You can't skip 100 at first, but if you practice, you'll mount up. That's what mother said. She says nothing will do her more good than skipping rope. It's the sensiblest toy a child can have. Let her play out in the fresh air skipping, and it'll stretch her legs and arms and give her some strength in 'em."
It was plain that there was not a great deal of strength in Mistress Mary's arms and legs when she first began to skip. She was not very clever at it, but she liked it so much that she did not want to stop.
"Put on thy things and run and skip out of doors," said Martha. "Mother said I must tell you to keep out of doors as much as you could, even when it rains a bit, so as the wrap up warm."
Mary put on her coat and hat and took her skipping rope over her arm. She opened the door to go out, and then suddenly thought of something and turned back rather slowly.
"Martha," she said, "they were your wages. It was your twopence, really. Thank you."
She said it stiffly, because she was not used to thanking people or noticing that they did things for her.
"Thank you," she said, and held out her hand, because she did not know what else to do.
Martha gave her hand a clumsy little shake, as if she was not accustomed to this sort of thing either. Then she laughed.
"Eh, that a queer old womanish thing," she said. "If tha'd been our Elizabeth Ellen, tha'd have give me a kiss."
Mary looked stiffer than ever.
"Do you want me to kiss you?"
Martha laughed again.
"Nay, not me," she answered. "If thou was different, p'raps thou'd want to thysel, but thou isn't. Run off outside and play with thy rope."
Mistress Mary felt a little awkward as she went out of the room. Yorkshire people seemed strange, and Martha was always rather a puzzle to her. At first she had disliked her very much, but now she did not. The skipping rope was a wonderful thing. She counted and skipped and counted until her cheeks were quite red and she was more interested than she had ever been since she was born. The sun was shining and a little wind was blowing, not a rough wind, but one which came in delightful little gusts and brought a fresh scent of newly turned earth with it. She skipped round the fountain garden and up one walk and down another. She skipped at last into the kitchen garden and saw Ben Weatherstaff digging and talking to his robin, which was hopping about him. She skipped down the walk toward him, and he lifted his head and looked at her with a curious expression. She had wondered if he would notice her, She really wanted him to see her skip.
"Well," he exclaimed, "upon my word, perhaps thou art a young un after all, and perhaps thou's got child's blood in thy veins instead of sour buttermilk. Thou's skipped red into thy cheeks as sure as my name's Ben Weatherstaff. I wouldn't have believed thou could do it."
"I never skipped before," Mary said. "I'm just beginning. I can only go up to 20.
"Thou